Hello and welcome to the Echo Chamber Podcast. My name is Tony Groves and today we are talking vaccine inequality, to be honest with you. Now, this sounds really, really weird to be doing this now, having said that sentence. And nobody knows this, actually, not even Martin, because he's looking at me like, he's like, what is he going to say? This is our 500th episode of the Echo Chamber Podcast. And we've hit it today. We had talked about it as a milestone and whether we were going to go and say, if we get a celebrity guest or do some sort of big thing. And I thought to myself, we could do that. Absolutely, we could. But then I also thought that that wouldn't be true to what we've done all the way through. We've always tried to keep it and just keep on rolling. So, Martin, were you even aware?
I knew we were close to 500, like each one feels like a year. So I knew we were close. I find it really difficult to think that I've talked to you for about 500 hours. It's just incredible.
Yeah, no. And I, in fairness, I've been told I deserve a sainthood for
putting up with you. Yeah, you do. It's me that's going on the plinth beside Lark, and you heard him today. It's me.
See, the ego. Unbelievable. No, look, again, it is. 500 is it's a mark. It's something that's worth saying, even if we need to pretend that it's not. It's an achievement despite all of that, and we still are talking to one another despite all of the hassle. Look, I'm just gonna move us on, and we are going to talk vaccine inequality. And we have two brilliant guests today. We are joined by Maho Rivas, who you've heard on the podcast before. You've heard her on the Sunday shows. You've heard her on the podcast. She's a regular contributor, and we're joined again for the second time. Connor Reddy is joining us. Connor is actually he's only around the corner from me here in Finglas, but we're going to talk about that. Vaccine inequality and what it actually means, and I suppose the fairest place to start is with Maho, because you did write that very personal piece for the Irish Examiner that normalized it in people's eyes, what it actually meant. And I don't want you to upset you, but could you share a little bit about why you wrote the piece and the idea around what story you were telling, if you don't mind?
So I'll start with saying, you know, get it out of the way that, you know, let's just be honest in the fact that you brought the 500th episode, you're celebrating by bringing someone from Cork. So let's just get that out of the way. So I'm from Cork. Now, I usually identify myself as someone from Cork, but I happen to be born in Paraguay. So, and I have my roll of toilet paper for the, you know, people who are looking at this in Zoom. You know, I was, for anyone who is, you know, who's under a rock, I am an immigrant, you know, and that's usually very clear from my social media and everything. And I was born in Paraguay, as I said. And I guess it just, it reached a point where I was just like, look, enough with crying while cycling. And that literally was happening. And just see what else I could do to bring attention to the fact that, you know, it's just really worrying. It's just I'm going to own my emotions and be hard. People are dying, and we have a role in that. And this is why I could never be a politician. I don't think I just break down a lot. You know, people are dying, and the situation is really hard in other places of the world. And we have a role in that. And I think we don't want to think of ourselves as baddies, and we want to think that we're really good people. All of us, but I think Ireland sees itself perhaps as a, you know, a neutral country, and we went for the, you know, Human Rights Committee in the UN, and we're the good guys, and we want to think that historically, because of what the country has gone through, and, you know, I am Irish, so I am on this as well, that we're the good guys in the picture. But whether we like it or not, we are part of a bigger machine and a bigger system that is getting in the way of a vaccine policy. So what happened was, I don't know, have people are aware of the, you know, there were surges, infections, and Brazil is doing really badly. Paraguay is right there, sandwiched next to Brazil. And the cases are off the roof. And I think earlier, just a week before that article was out, in a single day, there were 2,000 new cases in Paraguay. And I was, you know, And it's really hard in terms of, I look at numbers in Ireland and I look at numbers in Paraguay. And I had, you know, it's, you're living in, you know, liminally in two worlds and looking at how are things in one place and how are things in the other. And, you know, there was that one day and there were 2,000 new cases. And those are just the cases that are detected, I guess, in a way. Much more confident on the, you know, death numbers, because those are usually better recorded. But the cases that are detected are only people who get to be tested. And it's just really, really worrying when you have your family there. Again, it's just, it's hard. It's hard. And I guess I just wanted to do something. And
You did.
I wrote that piece.
Yeah. And you wrote that wonderful piece that captured the essence of, you know, the because we see numbers and we see them and we become desensitized to the stories behind those numbers. And, you know, it's easy for us to turn around and we're all watching graphs. We're watching what this means. And it's like, oh, there's a spike.
And it's not a video game. Like, no. It's just, and what I said in that piece, and you know, there was a lot and it was personal. Like I was back a year ago and I was still working in the office. I remember I was still going to work. That I got the diagnosis of my dad having pancreatic cancer. And I'm informed enough that I knew that it wasn't, you know, people don't survive pancreatic, like Jobs, you know, couldn't save himself with all his money. And I couldn't know. And I couldn't travel to see my family. And I knew that that was going to happen. And you kind of, you just know, because you're a migrant, you know. And funnily enough, you know, I couldn't travel to see my family because I was going to be stuck in a hotel for 2 weeks before I could see them. And that's right. And that, and I think when people talk about, and maybe that's a different conversation, but it's related to COVID, when people talk about mandatory hotel quarantine and the pain, I've been there, you know, well, I didn't get there because of how things are. And it's just having lost family in between that, knowing when I'll be able to try again, not knowing when my family's going to get vaccinated. And if they're not vaccinated, how realistic is it that I'll be able to hug them again? And I guess my mom and my sisters, two of my sisters and one of my brothers, they are in, like, well, most of my family who are left are in very high risk groups. So it's fucking terrifying, you know. I don't know when I'll see them or if I'll see them again. And it's just, you know, and it's just not about me, just about me. It's about millions of families, of loved ones who are in the same situation. I guess, you know, yeah, just put it on the one thing.
Well, yeah, this is going to seem like the worst segue in the world, but Connor, you've been vaccinated, first of all, because you're actually you're working on COVID. In effect, in Ireland, you work in James's Hospital. You've been I've heard great things about the work you guys are doing, especially around that level. But you also wrote a very interesting post just on social media about vaccine inequality. And I know, you know, obviously your political leanings, you care greatly about that inequality. Do you want to just explain, first of all, some of the stuff you do and why you put that post up yourself?
Well, look, I'm working in science myself. I'm a first year PhD student with Clinan Kelly, and I guess a lot of our work aims to unpick health inequalities and to look how they're kind of biologically embedded and whatever else. And that's really interesting stuff, but it's maybe a conversation for another day. I think really what my work has done is it's shown me that there's like a social basis to science, and that science can be a great liberatory tool, that it can save and improve people's lives in a really, really important, dramatic way. I guess I wrote the post when I started to see some of those figures about the global vaccine rollout from organisations like the People's Vaccine Alliance and UNICEF and Amnesty and others. And I think it's worth kind of pouring over those for a second. Dr. Ngozi, who's the head of the World Trade Organization at the minute, had a press conference during the week, and I was really struck by the figure there. 70% of all the COVID vaccines that have been given out at the minute have been administered in just 10 countries. 10 countries. Rich countries are vaccinating people at a rate of one vaccine every second. Meanwhile, there's countries that haven't administered even a single dose. And if we look at the projections at the minute, Oxfam are projecting that 90% of people in the world's 67 poorest countries won't have any access to COVID vaccines at all in the next year. So really what we have is a situation of global vaccine apartheid, and that behind those numbers are millions of lives, millions of people that were putting at risk. It is a moral outrage, but I guess it goes beyond that too. Brazil was mentioned already, and what's happening in Brazil right now is really, I think, a warning to the rest of the world. Back in October, there was a study that showed 50 to 75% of people in Manaus in Brazil had prior infection or evidence of prior infection. In November, another wave struck, this new Brazilian variant, so-called Brazilian variant. And within a couple of weeks, the hospitals are completely overwhelmed. They actually ran out of oxygen, so they had to go to other countries to look for oxygen supplies. And now what was just happening in Manaus kind of spread to the rest of Brazil. So I guess the lesson in that is that the longer we wait to vaccinate people around the world, the greater the risk is that a new variant will come along that might avoid or completely protection from vaccines, and we back to square one. So I guess the zealous sort of protection of intellectual property by the pharmaceutical companies has put us all at risk, and it's not just a moral outrage, it's actually blindly illogical, and it makes me really angry. So that's really why I wrote the post.
It really is striking. We are probably more developed, we are more developed now than we have ever been, and yet when it came to the first global crisis, and it's the first real global crisis of maybe two generations, that neoliberalism and that neoliberal model brought it all back down to profit. And instead of being able to each country to manufacture generic versions of vaccines, the keys are held by a few very big players for intellectual property, and lives are being lost for the sake of profit. We could produce in every country. Every country could have it, but it's intellectual property, and the idea of intellectual property in a pandemic, which is even worse. This is not just an article. What do you think we should do, Connor?
Yeah, well, look, this isn't, I like to, when we're talking about this problem, I think it's worth looking at the broader context. This stuff around intellectual property and IP, patent monopolies, it's a larger picture. Since 1995, when the World Trade Organization was established, there have been millions of people that have died needless deaths because they haven't got access to essential medicines. So the vaccine story is just part of that larger problem of access to medicines globally. If you look at the 1990s, there's a great struggle in South Africa and other countries that are really struggling with HIV and AIDS to get access to medicines that at that stage had been available for over a decade to treat HIV. And it was only when South Africa and other actually African countries went and produced medicines off patent against the rules of global intellectual property order that things began to change, and that they were given access to those medicines. There's still plenty of diseases too that the system doesn't incentivize innovation around. I guess we'll get to it maybe a bit later, hopefully, but the whole idea that profit and patent protections drive innovation, I think it's absurd. If you look at these vaccines, these are public vaccines. The Moderna vaccine, I read, $2.5 billion of public money went into its production, $1 billion in direct funding from the US government, and about $1.5 billion more through the National Institutes of Health and other places. So this is a public vaccine. Johnson & Johnson, another $1 billion in public funding went into its development. And if you look at the Pfizer BioNTech one, €500 million from the German government went into its development. So the pharmaceutical companies are trying to have their cake and eat it, really. They've socialized the development costs, or the apparently risky bits that private capital would usually be used for, and now they're trying to privatize the profits. So this is something that's been going on since, as I said, the 90s, and hopefully we can get into the history of that, because I think until things change at that global level, the intellectual property order and intellectual property law, I think we're going to see this as a repeated problem, not just with COVID vaccines, but with other medicines, and maybe with vaccines for pandemics that are yet to come, unfortunately.
Maho, can I see you want to come in there? I was going to come to you anyway. Go on.
Yeah, no, I guess, you know, kind of like complimenting. It was very emotional earlier. I do cry. It's my country and I cry if I want to. You know, both are my countries and I cry if I want to. You know, kind of like, I guess, you know, even in terms of when we're talking about the vaccine distribution, you know, as Connor was saying, you know, billions of public money have gone into it. So this is not about stealing someone's cake and giving it to someone else. Like, we've all paid for it. You know, public money has gone into it. It's not in anyone's interest to get people unvaccinated. As you said, you know, look, we leave people unvaccinated, there is going to be an issue with collective safety. The, you know, the evolution of the new variants that we've had in terms of, you know, them being resistant or maybe vaccines not being as effective against that. But just in terms of, you know, look, right now we have artificial scarcity. We know that. But the fact is, you know, even if we said, look, no one else can make vaccine, the fact is that rich countries have bought three times what they need. So, you know, they've bought up all the stock, even stuff that hasn't even been produced yet and hasn't been, you know, manufactured yet. So the poorer countries, the countries with lower income are even, you know, last in the queue. And that's why we may be seeing that, you know, it's maybe 2022, 2023. We don't know when they're going to be accessing the vaccines. And just, you know, as you were saying, Connor, like Connor is working in a hospital. And I think this is the saddest thing. But I think when this all started, we all knew that the people who are at the front lines are the most vulnerable. Right now, we have healthcare workers who are gone unvaccinated in poorer countries. How the fuck is that fair? That's just not okay. And you know, Paraguay isn't great on GDPR, but I got a list from my mom of like the new 14 doctors who have gone into ICU. Doctors being intubated. Being, you know, saying goodbye to their wives because they know they're probably not going to come back from it. How is that okay? How is that fair that we have, you know, we're going to be moving on in other countries, you know, and I think we celebrate the UK an awful lot because a lot of healthcare people are getting vaccinated there. But what we don't see is the limited number of vaccines for many reasons. And we're going to get into the politics of that. What that means is that there's people going without vaccines who are at the front lines, who are working, as you said, without oxygen. There are no more beds. Like in, I can compare with, there are no more beds. You can see people in hospitals sitting in chair with their, you know, with their drips next to it, next to them. Like not even trolleys anymore. There are no more chairs. There are people camping outside of hospitals, waiting for someone to die to get a hospital bed. And that's just not okay. Like people who cannot afford the medication to keep them alive, who cannot afford the medication that you need to be able to be intubated because you have to be unconscious to be, you know, like I'm not a doctor, I'm a human rights lawyer, but that, like, how is that okay? How is any of this okay? How, like, we have to, and here, you know, we're going to reach the ask in it, but, you know, how is this moral? And we have to show moral leadership. And when I started the conversation, and maybe I didn't finish thought when I said about us Ireland thinking that we're the goodies and we're good guys in the picture, you know, you know, when we are talking about the intellectual property, and this came out, and my article came out actually because of the vote that happened at the World Trade Organization, where the EU, of which Ireland is a member, voted against the waiving of the TRIPS of the intellectual property, just, you know, to allow for lives to be saved. It's fucking outrageous. It's a podcast, so I guess I can swear. You know, so it is very angering. And I said that this is being done in our name and with our taxes. Vaccines that are being funded publicly and decision making that is being done there. And maybe if we're not actively saying we don't want the vaccines to go to poorer countries, to brown and black people, it's happening because we are allowing that to happen. And my ask was for people to actually care and do something about it. Because all of this is being done in our name. And I've heard in the radio, I think, someone was on Claire Byrne saying, you know, we shouldn't let the, you know, someone representing pharmaceuticals, we shouldn't be lifting the restrictions because should no one else manufacture it? And I was like, so if no one else can manufacture it, why do you care so much about lifting restrictions? So maybe they can. You know, it just doesn't. You know, it's not logical. And the, you know, aside from the, you know, the TRIPS waiver within the WTO, we also have CTAB that is about sharing the technology, sharing the how to. I don't necessarily think that every country in the world will be able to produce it if they don't have perhaps the resources of the technology, but certainly more countries could be participating in this and we could make a difference with that. And, you know, maybe then we can talk about the fact that very, very recently, 26th of March, you know, there was a piece there where the European Union said that, you know, no vaccine can leave the EU if we're not ensuring that European people are vaccinated. And the Taoiseach himself said, you know, that.
He said the right thing in the evening and changes mind by the morning in one sense.
I wrote in the context of companies today, and this was 26th of March, the EU needs to have certain safety nets in respect of making sure that it has sufficient vaccines for its own population. So let's just change the discourse for a moment. Let's say we're not talking about vaccines. Let's say we're talking about food. If people are hungry in another place and we're refusing to share the food that we have in abundance and to do this in a fair way or share the technology for it to be produced so that people don't starve to death, how's that fair? And we've been through that. Yes. We've had the issue and also the vaccines that were produced in India that were shipped to the UK. How does not replicate colonialism of taking food from one place to feed people in another?
I could use an awful Churchill quote right now, but I won't do it.
I'm only come lately to Ireland, but I've heard enough about how unfair it is to take stuff from some people, starve others, and people are dying. And you know, look, I think we need to give a harder look on ourselves and what we're doing.
Connor, you want to come in?
Yeah, I think it's worth just while the point is being made about how we're called for this of structural adjustment programs in Africa and Latin America and Asia have left them basically facing into this pandemic with their hands tied behind their back. If you look at health budgets in these countries, it's maybe not as sexy as vaccines, which are kind of seen as a bit of a silver bullet, but just the numbers of nurses and doctors and health professionals in the global south. These countries hemorrhage highly trained medical professionals every year to global north because there's essentially not developed health systems in those countries at all. So there's places in Africa at the minute that don't even have facilities to give patients high flow oxygen or anything like that. But this goes back to a legacy of, I guess, colonialism, imperialism, and I guess more recently, the way that the International Monetary Fund and other organizations have behaved, that whenever we give aid, it comes with strings attached, and there are certain obligations, cutting back public spending on things that actually could tackle this pandemic and bring it to an end. So the kind of public health response is less sexy, but it's absolutely crucial. You look at Vietnam. Vietnam's not a rich country by any standard, but they've done very well because they had a well-developed public health infrastructure. They had the basics right, and they're well-funded. But if you look at the countries where there've been structural adjustment programs and pushed by the global north, these are the countries that are most vulnerable and that will find it hardest to get vaccines out too. That's the other side of this. So I think we're very culpable. It's a question of actually owing this to people in the global south as well as ourselves after legacy of colonialism, I think, and more recent stuff.
And this comes back to pre-pandemic times. We were looking at and cancer drugs and how pharmaceutical companies were concentrating on very niche cancers where they could charge an awful lot of money for the drugs that they were using. And somebody said, look, if there is a cure for cancer, but you can't afford it, therefore it's not a cure for cancer. And we're in the same boat with this pandemic. If you can't get access to the drugs to get the vaccine, well, then you don't actually have a cure. Even though it exists, you don't have a cure for the pandemic. How do we equalize the pitch? How do we make it fair for everybody?
Can I just add to what Connor was saying? You know, like, I don't even think we have to go as far as colonialism in terms of the inequality that, you know, and it is a wider conversation for sure. But when I think I framed it in my article, and one of my concerns is, so here we're talking about Ireland. We have somewhat of a safety net. I'm not saying that it's in any way appropriate, but people cannot go to work. is something there in terms of supporting people. And as I said, one of the things that I always say to Irish people is you have to value having a social welfare system, and it has to be made better and stronger. But right now what's happening in a lot of low income countries is that there is no social welfare payment. You have to go to work or you starve, and that's it. You starve, and people have to go out and risk themselves and risk others to get infected. And that is a product of inequality. And we don't even have to go into colonialism. We have to look at the Mercosur deal. And that's a whole other conversation in terms of how much the, you know, for example, agriculture and cattle industrialized levels of, and the soy that comes to feed the cattle that we breed here in Europe, that's not paying any tax or paying very little tax into these countries so that they can afford to support their citizens with having appropriate healthcare systems where healthcare workers are paid properly, appropriate social welfare systems, you know, building public housing and all of these things that are required to, for people to be safe, that are part of a public health strategy of keeping people safe. And that is something that is very much happening. And that's a conversation that we're going to have when it comes to Mercosur. And, you know, it is an issue as well. And that's something that we are doing right now. It's not even colonialism 200 years ago. We have to look at how the actions that the model of production and the model of food that we have and the model of industry that we have right now is doing that exact same thing. And I wouldn't even say it about, you know, kind of like healthcare workers. They're migrants, free to go wherever they want to go. But sometimes they do leave because the conditions are very bad in their countries. So what is happening is that they cannot be paid appropriately in those countries. And that's why they're leaving. So I wouldn't stop them from coming, but they have to be supported to do their best there. So, you know, it is part of a wider set of inequalities. And we could even look at all of the companies that are paying taxes, inverted commas, or that are based in Europe, that are engaging in this sort of practices in, you know, exploiting global south.
And it's,
you know,
extractivism, yeah, isn't it? It is.
And this is a continuation of it. You know, but it's just really interesting how, you know, like a lot of the food in the world and so much, it, you know, even when we think about the industrialist world, you know, most workers, when it comes to industry and what, you know, some people might define as blue collar, whatever, so much work is done in the global south, but it is continuously being, you know, extracted, you know, the richness of the place and the resources and the food and everything else, the rivers, the trees, everything, you know, we look at that and where is the wealth going? Not staying there. And certainly taxes aren't staying there. But this is the conversation about vaccines. So
No. I think this is really crucial. Both of you have been able to point out really better than me and Martin ever could how this is not just unique to the vaccine situation. This is a model that has just been replicated via the vaccine situation. Yeah. And that is what we're talking about ultimately. We're here to talk about vaccine inequality and vaccine capitalism in effect. But it's important that we point out that this is the model that the West has implemented, and we have continued to use it to the point whereby we've seen, you know, I saw phrases used today about, you know, some healthcare workers not been, due to the changes and how they want to roll it out, they're no longer eligible when they thought they were going to be eligible. And at the same time, our friend who we have regularly on the podcast, Seamus Malakazali, was putting up in everybody in Minnesota on over the age of 16 from yesterday is now eligible to get a vaccine. Now, how do you, like, if Ireland is behind the eight ball, to use that awful term, imagine how much further some other countries aren't even on the same playing surface. They're way down somewhere else in the back. And that's where the reality of this is. To go back to Martin's point, if I can, how do we bring some sort of public pressure? It's just very, Connor, I know you're very active, and I see Maho. I'll let both of you have a good go at this one, if you don't mind.
Let Connor start.
Yeah, well, I mean, look, at the start of the pandemic, there was actually a bit of optimism. And I don't know, I personally thought just the scale of the crisis would force a different approach to how drugs and potentially vaccines would be developed. Majo mentioned it earlier on, but the Common Technology Access Pool, or CTAP, I was quite hopeful about that. I thought in a situation that's crippled the world, that's inflicted suffering in all four corners of the planet, that there would be some drive to have cooperation, international collaboration, sharing of technologies between companies. Like, it was the rational way to produce a vaccine or to produce a therapy if you wanted to end the pandemic. Unfortunately, when it was brought forward by a couple of countries as a potential way of doing things, it was completely rubbished by the EU, the US, all the usual suspects, really. So I think it was maybe apparent to us because we're kind of clued into this stuff. Most people had no clue about the CTAP initiative. No, most people have no idea about how medicines are developed. So I think what we have to do is kind of bring these arguments to people, because the rational response would be to have a cooperative not-for-profit system to develop medicines. If we look at the international or the intellectual property regime around the world, it's actually quite a new innovation. I guess it has its ultimate roots, maybe the more recent stuff in the Bayh Dole Act in the US, which was passed, I think, by Reagan in 1985. What that set down basically was the government are allowed to fund private research, but they're not allowed to directly benefit from it. So the government are allowed to give money to pharmaceutical companies or other industries, but they're not allowed to put, say, we give you $1 billion, you give us 100,000 vaccines or whatever. You weren't allowed to do that. So I guess that set the scene. And in the 90s, you had this kind of process of formation around the World Trade Organization. Prior to the World Trade Organization, intellectual property was operated through a parallel organization called the World Intellectual Property Organization. It's basically toothless. So I guess the consequences for going outside or making medicines off patent, or maybe copying another medicine, making something similar to it somewhere else in the world, WIPO could sanction you, but they did. It was really a toothless thing. So what the kind of neoliberal hawks did is they brought intellectual property within to the remit of the World Trade Organization. So then all of a sudden, trade, which every country like depends on, and your ability to trade is dependent on your compliance with a global intellectual property regime. So we basically held other
countries to ransom. Before I go to you, Maho, can I just say one thing on the IP thing? If people think this isn't all related, we've done a series with the Global Alliance for Tax Justice as well. And the latest thing now, obviously, is using intellectual property to make sure we don't have to pay any taxes in the countries that we're supposed to be benefiting. Even the countries like Ireland, where we've seen countries put 4.3 billion, two companies put 4.3 billion beyond the reach of taxation in any country, just by using tricks of IP, of selling IP to one another. Sorry, Maho, for coming. I just wanted to point that out. It's important.
Well, look, I'm if we have 5 minutes at the end, I'd just like to bring up all of the other ways that we're affecting people from the global south through Irish policy. But, you know, look, I do think Connor was saying, you know, people, if people were aware, if people knew more, I do want to always believe in the kindness of people. And it's proven again and again that we, if given a chance, I do think that people want to do the right thing, and that's one of the reasons why I wrote the article. And I'm very privileged. I know an awful lot of people, and an awful lot of people know about me. So I was like, look, if I can guilt trip a few people into learning and caring a bit more about this, I hadn't even shared news and inverted commas to a lot of people about my father passing and everything. But I do think there's something there. There's an element there in terms of letting people know what's being done in our name. And there's an awful lot of stuff that's being done in our name that it's not okay. I don't think that if people understood the consequences fully, and I guess we are overwhelmed in terms of how many things we need to care about and how many things are wrong in this world. But if looking at kind of like what are the aspects, what people need to do right now, it's just like we need to make we need to make an issue out of this, and that's why I wrote the piece. Like, people need to know and need to make themselves heard in terms of the European initiatives that's been brought, in terms of signing to supporting the waiving of TRIPS. We need to be demanding out of our public representatives. They're only going to be based on they only care about what's going to get them voted on. we know how this works. So if they don't feel that there's a need or a hunger for this to matter, it's not going to matter. And we've seen how time and time again, we've dragged the establishment to doing the right thing when it came to space-based issues. So we need to drag them once again. There is the issue about, you know, and I've said to people, look, if you can sign that petition that I shared in the article, brilliant, the European petition, the European Citizens Initiative. But I also urgently need people, and I'm telling all my loved ones, you know, like, if you love me, literally guilt-tripping them, please share about this to five other people. You need to talk to five more. You need to write to your representative. You need to get this there. People are dying. And it's because of this artificial scarcity and this selfishness and greed. And all of this is being done in name. It's being on behalf of the Irish government and on behalf of the EU. So I think I'm very clear in my asks, you know, in terms of, you know, like, yes, in that, but also make noise and you know, talk to your representatives. Because it's just not okay. But what Connor was saying, I think it's just really important earlier. This is not the first pandemic. And there are other issues in terms of when we had the AIDS epidemic. We need to be really honest about that. We were also selfish when it came to medication, and who were the people mostly impacted were LGBT people, mainly gay men, were, you know, black people in Africa. There were people that, you know, what the establishment didn't care about them. So that was, you know, how much news did it make among some circles, the circles that do have the decision making. So we have to acknowledge that there are certain types of oppression and power that are being again replicated in this case. And in this case, you know, the pandemic is affecting a wider number of people, the people who are being benefited, who are being, you know, first in the queue to get the vaccination are those who are, who have access to power or wealth or are adjacent to it. And I think we were so rightly annoyed when people were accessing vaccines, not based on need, but because of being adjacent to power. When the Coombe thing happened and when the B thing happened, this is exactly the same thing. It has to be based on need. And it you know, we are a global family, and I would like to, you know,
the phrase is, it's a global pandemic. Why aren't we thinking globally? Has been said several times. And I know people are using the other phrase. What's it? No one's safe till everyone's safe kind of thing. Yet we just refuse to actually engage that because we're, you know, we're hearing of, you know, the 20 teachers, people in a crèche, people bringing vaccines home. Missing vaccines, that, you know, that misuse of the registration, you know, people showing up at places and not being checked, all of that. Everybody vaccinated is a great thing. Let's tell the truth. Okay. Let's not just knock that, but we do need to be, we also need to understand that and the other thing that I hate to point out again, you both will probably correct me, but I love the idea that we decide, you know, oh, this is the Brazilian variant. This is the, this, you know, it's let's build our hegemonic infrastructure into how we term these things. And I always go back, Mark, we've said this a thousand times, you know, the Spanish flu started in Arkansas, folks. They just decided that would be uncomfortable to brand it.
Can we actually expand on that? We need, and I was saying that about framings of this, and you know, look, one thing is the vaccine is good, it's needed, especially for health workers, but there are other ways that we can, in the meantime, handle and reduce the impact of this pandemic. And we need to talk about mandatory hotel quarantine, and we need to talk about everything else. But we need to talk about how racism is cross-cutting every measure. And I have so many things to be angry about. And currently, I'm trying to focus my energy in terms of the vaccine. But we need to know, on the 17th of February, Ireland imposed visa restrictions to non-visa required countries, South Africa and South American countries. Excuse was that there's strong advice, and I'm quoting Helen McEntee here, 10th of March in a peak due to Holly Cairns. The strong advice that everyone, regardless of nationality or visa per clearance status or where they started their travel from, who could not provide proven essential purpose, it shouldn't travel to Ireland. And that was the excuse to demand visas for those countries that weren't previously required. And right now, as of now, we know that visas are not being accepted or processed from those countries. So, but they're in the mandatory quarantine list. So, you know, like these people who can't even reach our country are on the list for mandatory quarantine. And that was a complete inappropriate measure, because it was people from Paraguay, from Brazil, from South Africa, who had those passports only, who weren't able to reach us. But if you had someone Irish who's coming from Brazil or someone Irish who is coming from South Africa, there wasn't even mandatory quarantine back then. Statutory instrument doesn't have a sunset clause. That means that we don't know when it's going to end. Myself and many other people are very worried that when a visa requirement has been set, it hasn't been lifted. And I am genuinely, after all of this pandemic is done, will my family ever be able to visit me? Because I'm familiar enough with how the visa system works in this country, and it's a black
hole. That's actually a really fantastic point. I'm going to let Connor come in now as well, but I just want to make, we will have to go to ICCL on this, Martin, to get another handle on this as well, because it's something, I'm glad you raised it. I hadn't heard it put together as brilliantly as you just did. Connor, sorry, we are short on time, folks. We are going to have to, but this is, Connor, if you want to give us your last couple of thoughts maybe, and we can start to move towards the wrap.
Yeah, sure. I guess, like, I'll say this as someone who's working in science and wants to have a career in science. I said at the start, science has a massive liberatory potential, but that liberatory potential won't be realised unless, I guess, who controls science changes in some sort of way, and that science is done in the interests of people, and a great majority of people around the world benefit from it rather than a small number of pharmaceutical companies or whatever. If you look from 2010 to 2011, only 37 drugs out of 450 that were approved in the US were for neglected diseases. So these are things, neglected diseases is maybe a bit of a misnomer, because these are diseases that affect millions of people around the world. If you look at hepatitis C, there's 200 million people that are estimated to be infected around the world. The minute intellectual property is restricting, generics and being manufactured to treat a lot of those people. So unless you're in a global north or wealthy country that can actually provide access to that medicine, you don't have it. And that virus will continue to grow. Those numbers will continue to spread. That applies to so many other things as well. So I guess we have to win a people's vaccine. Obviously, that's the immediate goal. But we have to take the lesson as well. And I think we have to start fighting for a science for the people. And I think something along the lines of global not-for-profit pharmaceutical system, something that takes the power out of the hands of big businesses and gives it to people democratically. Pandemics are coming thick and fast, new pathogens arising at a frightful rate, so this won't be the last either. So I think it's really important we have that. And just a final thing I'll say is that I kind of got at it earlier, but there's this myth that profit drives innovation. That's not been the case for a very long time. It's not been the case of the vaccines, which have been largely publicly funded, but it's not the case at most marketed drugs either. Most pharmaceutical drugs that you see are built on a foundation of public research. And I guess as a scientist, if I were to come up with something tomorrow, I'd almost be forced by the pressure of the system to sell my IP to a pharmaceutical company who could choose to use it or not use it. And there's no way for me, even if it's really beneficial, to bring that to people around the world and to give them access to it at an affordable price. So I think we need to start building and looking at alternatives to the way that we develop drugs at the minute and the way that we produce them too. There's a bit of a prejudice and a kind of antiquated view of how drug development is done. If you look at even CEPI and Gavi, the global vaccine initiative, the only companies that they actually invested in were Western owned vaccine manufacturers. There wasn't any money for Sinopharm or Sinovac. There wasn't much for CureVac or for the Cuban vaccine that's in phase 3 clinical trials at the minute. So I think we have to get out of that mindset as well, that only the West can do things, that only the US and Europe can lead when it comes to pharmaceutical innovation and production. This stuff is happening elsewhere in the world. It can happen more, and it should begin with a new vaccine.
And I'm just, before I wrap, I'm reminded that when the American-produced AIDS drugs were too expensive for the southern world, it was India that produced generic versions that made it available for everybody else. And the development of this vaccine has brought us to a cusp. It is genetic medicine. It has brought us to a cusp where we will be able to deal with much more diseases going forward. It's been a huge breakthrough, these vaccines and how they were developed. And it has shown a pathway how we can deal with many, many more diseases, but they must be equitably able to be accessed. And that's going forward post-pandemic. Like to thank you both for coming on. It's been a really in-depth conversation, and we will have to come back to this. And I think we will definitely have to come back to it, Tony.
I'm actually raging that I'd go on for another while, because you two, this has been one of the best. I'm so glad we did this as our 500th. I'm genuinely so glad, because I've gotten so much out of it. It makes such a difference. I hope everybody listens. We will share the links to the petition. We will share the other stuff. But nonetheless, I think Maho made the real call, is you have to raise your voice and let your directly elected, your local TD, your local county councillor know, because that's where the change comes from. Outside of that, that's what matters. I'm not even going to do a patron shout out this time. We're just going to say thank you to Maho Rivas and to Conor Reddy for their time. I'm so glad that we did this like this. Thanks so much, guys. And everybody, mind yourselves out there. Take care.
Thanks, Emil.
Tony and Martin, Martin and Tony, speaking to interesting people only. It's the Echo Chamber Podcast. Subscribe now on Patreon.